Hello, Iris listeners. Welcome to Hour 3 of the Des Moines Register. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. I'll begin this hour, as always, with the obituaries. Thomas Roy Harris, Sergeant Major, retired. Tom was born on June 15, 1959, to Lloyd Robert and Ardith Jean Mertz Harris in Atlantic, at Atlantic Memorial Hospital. He died January 24th. Tom was baptized at First Presbyterian Church in Adair and confirmed at Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Oneida. The family resided in Oneida, where Tom attended both elementary and high school, graduating in 1977. After high school, Tom attended Iowa State University. After 1 year, Tom began working with his father, building bridges, until he entered the military in 1988. Joining the Army. In 1991, upon discharge from the Army, Tom joined the Iowa National Guard. Tom served tours in Korea, returned stateside during Desert Storm, and served a tour in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom from 2005 to 6, where he earned the nickname Yard Hawk from his brothers in arms. Tom was medically retired from the Iowa Army National Guard on April 7, 2013. Which also served as his final pinning ceremony. He ended his career with our armed forces as Sergeant Major Thomas Harris. In his retirement, Tom enjoyed spending time with family, gardening, hunting, and trapping. He also served on the Oneida City Council and was serving as mayor of the city of Oneida at the time of his death. Tom battled cancer for 10 years, defying the odds several times. He came home to be close to family on Thursday, January 21st, entrusted to the care of hospice at Caring Acres. His final days were spent with visits from family and friends. He was feeling better and more at peace than he had been in quite some time, and was ready to meet his Lord and Savior. Tom loved his mother and sisters dearly, but oftentimes merely tolerated them. He learned to love the outdoors partly as a way to escape being outnumbered. His favorite times were spent outside and with his nieces and nephews and great-nieces and nephews. He loved and protected them fiercely. He instilled in each of them a strong work ethic and led this venture by example. He enjoyed researching his family history and learning where he came from, and he enjoyed sharing this information. His nieces and nephews often joked about all the information he was able to share, especially how far back he managed to go. We never knew who he was talking about. He was a collector of coins and books, enjoying the history behind each. His love of books is shared among the family, and it wasn't unusual for him to be reading multiple books at the same time on more than one topic. He firmly believed that knowledge was power and never stopped learning. Tom also loved spending time with his service dog, Missy, and the two were nearly inseparable. He was a fan of the Iowa State Cyclones, enjoying bantering with Uncle Larry Harris, a big Nebraska fan, cheering on the Hawks so long as the two teams weren't playing. He also enjoyed watching the Chicago Cubs and Kansas City Chiefs. He will be thrilled to have the best seat in the house as the Chiefs take on the Buccaneers in the Super Bowl. His family will remember him as loving those who feel unlovable, giving grace and lots of second chances, teaching lessons they didn't know they needed, and sharing stories of all his life's adventures. He was fiercely loyal. Once you were a friend, he would defend you without question. He was a great storyteller and never spared a detail. He believed without a doubt that Jesus Christ was his Lord and Savior and prayed for everyone. He had no doubt that his sins would be forgiven and his faith would take him home to the kingdom of heaven, greeted by some of his favorite people. Tom is survived by his mother, Ardith, his sisters, Carrie Hicks of Tempe, Arizona, Lori Glissman, spouse Ryan of Oneida, Jody Meyer, spouse Kevin of Indianola, Michelle Renee Hartwig, spouse Heath of Cedar Falls, and his brother-in-law, T.J. Hicks of Tempe, Arizona. Tom is also survived by the loves of his life, his many nieces, nephews, and great-nieces and nephews. John Glissman, spouse Tiffany, their children Parker, Hayden, Connor, Bennett, and Braylee, Robert, spouse Cassie Herrig, their children Rylan and Callum, Megan Dorsey, spouse Clayton, their children Ashton and Reed, Graydon Hicks, spouse Carla, and their children Emma, Emery, Lily, and Natalie, Caitlin Hodges, spouse Nick, and their children Sophia Carver, Thomas, and Riker, Kylie Hicks and her baby due in August of 2021, Jordan Meyer and her children Amaya and Ruger, Shelby Hartwig, spouse Kobe Smith, Bailey Hartwig, and Nicole Pop, mother of Rylan, Kira, and Nora. Tom is also survived by many aunts, uncles, and cousins, as well as many of his brothers and sisters of the 224th Engineer Battalion and the Iowa Army National Guard. Tom is preceded in death by his father, grandparents Fred and Viola Mertz, and Ellen and Elma Harris, his nephew Keegan Meyer and great-nephew Luca Hodges and Rachel Glissman, mother of Parker, Hayden, and Connor. The family thanks you for the outpouring of support. Tom touched many lives over the years, each of them being better for having had him in it. Visitation with family will be from 10 to 11 a.m., with a funeral starting at 11 a.m. on Saturday, January 30th at Zion Lutheran Church in Atlantic. Hockenberry Family Care in Atneeta is in charge of the arrangements. Condolences may be sent to www.hockenberryfamilycare.com. James G. Nelson, Sr., age 79, of Ankeny and Lake Havasu City, Arizona, passed away on Monday, January 18th in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. A visitation will be held Thursday, January 28th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ankeny Funeral Home, followed by rosary service for family at 7 p.m. A funeral mass will be Friday, January 29th at 11 a.m. at All Saints Catholic Church, 650 Northeast 52nd Avenue, Des Moines, 50313. Cremation will take place following the service, and a private family ceremony will be held at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery at a later date. Please visit www.ankenyfuneralhome.com for full obituary and live streaming of the funeral mass due to COVID-19 restrictions. Barbara Joanne Glombowski, née Wilson, passed away on Friday, January 22nd, surrounded by her loving family. She was born on October 31st, 1942, to Gail Edward and Paula Maxine Wilson in Waterloo. She survived 48 years of wedded bliss to her husband, Paul Glombowski. In addition, she is survived by her loving daughter, Laura Canal, spouse Tony, and her three grandchildren and lights of her life, Enzo, Ella, and Gio. Her rescue dogs, Ziva and Jethro, her brothers, Tom Wilson, spouse Cindy, Larry Wilson, spouse Chris, Richard Wilson, and many nieces and nephews. Barbara was preceded in death by her beloved daughter, Joanna, her parents, and her brother, James Wilson. Services at this time will be private. The family will hold a memorial service at a future time when it is safe for travel. In lieu of flowers, please send donations in her memory to Trinity United Methodist Church, 605 West Gulf Road, Mount Prospect, Illinois, 60056. Information, call 847-255-7800 or www.friedrichsfh.com. Evelyn Jadishisi, 81, of Des Moines, passed away on Thursday, January 21st, surrounded by her beloved husband and three sons. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, January 30th at McLaren's Rest Haven Chapel in West Des Moines, with a visitation from 9:30 a.m. until service time at McLaren's. Please join the live stream at www.mclarensresthavenchapel.com. Interment will be at Rest Haven Mausoleum at a later date. Left to cherish her memory include her husband of 35 years, Dominic, three sons, Jim Stone, Tom Stone, and Jerry Stone, four stepchildren, Lisa Seitz, spouse Mitch, Larry Giudicisi, spouse Yvette, Lou Giudicisi, spouse Roxanne, Dominic Giudicisi spouse Kelly Hafer, 12 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and her feline friend Tessa. Evelyn was preceded in death by her parents and son Michael Stone. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made to the Alzheimer's Association of Iowa. Donald D. Myers, age 94, passed away Saturday, January 23rd. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m. with funeral service at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, January 28th at Hamilton's Funeral Home, 605 Lyon Street in Des Moines. Burial will follow at Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter at 11 a.m. A Zoom link will be provided in Donald's full obituary notice on Hamilton's website, which is www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com, for those who wish to watch the service remotely. Donald Dean Myers was born May 27, 1926, to parents Dexter Dean Myers and Chiquita Faye Opp in Cambria. He attended Cambria Consolidated School and graduated in 1943. He was active in sports, mainly basketball and track. After graduation at age 17, he joined the U.S. Navy. He participated in several operations, including the invasion of Okinawa and the Philippines. He was both in World War II and the Korean War. After he was discharged, he attended AIB Business College and graduated in 1947. Upon graduation, he was employed by 3E, Electrical Engineering and Equipment, where he was a sales rep for 45 years. That is where he met his future wife, June Ann Harvey, who he married April 7th of 1950. 5 children were born over the next 12 years. As a family, they traveled and camped often. After Don retired from 3E in 1992, he and June spent a lot of their time at their lake home in Panorama. He enjoyed golf, boating, and fishing. Those left to mourn his passing include his brother, George Edwin Myers, spouse Bev, his 5 children, Douglas Myers, Randall Myers, spouse Carmen, Lori Schuster, Cynthia Lyon, spouse Jeff, Pam Payne, 13 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, several nieces and nephews, and other family and special friends. He was preceded in death by his parents and his sister, Glendoris Coswell. Contributions can be made to the American Heart Association. Edna June Elliott of Bondurant died on January 24th at Mercy One Hospice in Johnston after a brief illness. She was married to Robert J. Elliott, and together they made their home in Carlisle. She is survived by her children, Verlaine Rothfuss, spouse Roland of Pensacola, Florida, Jackie Melendez of Tucson, Arizona, Connie Mann, spouse Kelly of Altoona, Roberta Berry, spouse John of Indianola, Robert Elliott, spouse Carol of Carlisle, and Renee Van Ginkle, spouse Tim of Pleasant Hill. 17 grandchildren and 28 great-grandchildren. In addition to her husband, she was preceded in death by 8 siblings and a granddaughter in infancy, Katie Jo Elliott. Visitation for the public will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, January 29th at O'Leary Funeral Services in Norwalk. A private family service will be held with burial at Scotch Ridge Cemetery. For her full obituary, to sign her online guestbook, and to order flowers and gifts for the family using the local flower shop, visit www.o'learyfunerals.com or call 515-981-0700. Leo Ward, age 91, of Des Moines, died on January 23rd at Unity Point Hospital, where his Irish luck finally ran its course. Visitation will be held on Thursday, January 28th from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. with the family present to receive guests from 4 to 7 p.m. at O'Leary Celebration of Life Center in Norwalk. A Celebration of Life service will be held on Friday, January 29th at 11 a.m. at O'Leary Celebration of Life Center in Norwalk. A graveside burial service will follow at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Melrose at 1 p.m. Leo leaves behind a whole bunch of stuff that no one knows what to do with. but also a group of really sad family and friends. His daughters, Kathy Utterson, spouse David, Carol George, Sarah Horn, spouse Jeff, and Amy Blair, spouse Michael, and daughter-in-law Susan Ward. While he tolerated his children, it was his 12 grandchildren, Andy, spouse Sarah, Rob, spouse Monica, Joe, Tristan, Hayden, JP, Daniel, Mary, spouse Brandon, Matt, Rosie, Katie, and Jillian, and 4 great-grandchildren, Chloe, Niall, Zenny, and little Leo, whom he really loved. Leo also leaves behind his younger brother, Bill Ward of East Moline, and his many nieces and nephews. He will be greatly missed by his girlfriend, Barbara Melcher, and her children, Mary Jo Romanco and Matt Melcher. Leo is most likely enjoying a reunion and telling a whopper of a story to those who left before him. His wife of 50 years, Rita, his sons, John and Tom Ward, his granddaughter, Lucy Ward, his parents, Frank and Catherine, and siblings Don Ward, Mary Vernig, Helen Bertram, Carol Peters, John Ward, Marty Ward, and Judy Settles. The party never really started until Leo showed up, so they will be glad to see him. For his complete life story, online condolences, and to send flowers, visit www.o'learyfunerals.com or call directly at 515-981-0700. Thomas D. Greer, 63, of West Des Moines, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, January 19th. Tom was born on August 31, 1957, to Donald and Mary Greer. He was raised in West Des Moines and a graduate of Valley High School class of 1975. He was the distribution manager for Payless Cashways in Ankeny for many years before moving back to West Des Moines. He was a devoted father and grandfather and considered his family his greatest accomplishment. Tom never met a stranger and loved telling his favorite stories to make people laugh. He had a love for getting a good deal and cruising around town visiting neighbors in his 76 Jeep. Tom's favorite quote was that he was 29 and holding. Tom is survived by his children, Courtney Strait, Brad Greer, spouse Andrea, Brian Greer, spouse Letha, 7 grandchildren, his partner Bonita Litton, siblings Nancy Erickson, Debbie Grimm, spouse Jim, Steve Greer, spouse Shannon, as well as many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his daughter, Jennifer Greer, parents Donald and Mary Greer, and brother-in-law, Russ Erickson. A celebration of life will be held Sunday, January 31st, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Urbandale Senior Rec Center Community Room, 7305 Northwest Aurora Avenue in Urbandale, 50322. Masks are required. Ronald G. Krause, 84, died on January 25th at Iowa Methodist Hospital. Ron was born May 2, 1936, to Carl and Jeanette Wellhusen Krause in German Valley, Iowa. He was a 1954 graduate of Tatanka High School in Tatanka and a 1956 graduate of the American Technical School in Des Moines. He served in the U.S. Army for 2 years at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. Ron was united in marriage to Carol F. Holtzeiser on May 27, 1962 at the Central Christian Church in Marshalltown. The couple lived in Oskaloosa until 1971, when they moved to Des Moines. Ron retired as a transmission design engineer from U.S. West, previously Northwestern Bell, in 1990, where he had been employed for 34 years. A lifelong baseball fan, Ron, in his youth, rooted for the Cleveland Indians and his favorite player, Bob Feller. Always comfortable with a tool in his hand, he was a master of the home improvement project. If something needed fixed, installed, or replaced, he would get the job done. Even in retirement, he remained busy with his many projects. Ron is survived by his wife, Carol, daughter Brenda Cushing, spouse Greg of West Des Moines, son Kent Krause, spouse Jill of Lincoln, Nebraska, 2 grandchildren, Eric Cushing and Megan Cushing, sister Linda Berman, spouse Ed, sister-in-law Carol Ann Krause, and a niece, Karen Glazer, and nephew, Kevin Krause. Ron was preceded in death by his parents and two brothers, Lloyd and Eldon. The family is very grateful for the care provided by caring hearts. Ron was blessed with the love of and friendship from his great team of care providers for the past 3 years. Ron was a member of Hope Lutheran Church for nearly 50 years. Memorial contributions may be sent to the church at Hope Lutheran Church, 3857 East 42nd Street, Des Moines, Iowa, 50317. Condolences may be sent to the family care of Brenda Cushing, 1105 Burr Oaks Drive, West Des Moines, Iowa, 50266. Private services will be live streamed on Thursday, January 28th. Friends can join via live stream starting at 12:45 at www.islescares.com. That concludes the obituaries for today. I'll turn now to the sports section of the Register. The headline at the top of the page says, Cyclones give it a gritty effort. And this is a story about the late Monday game between Oklahoma State and Iowa State, where the final score was Oklahoma State 81, Iowa State 60. There are two pieces beneath that headline about this game, but I'm just going to have time to read one of them. So I'll do Randy Peterson's article, and his subtitle there says, ISU makes do after hit from COVID-19 protocols. Say what you want about the Big 12 protocol that mandates basketball teams must have at least 6 scholarship players to compete at a game. Fair, not fair, whatever. It's the rules, and that's why Iowa State had to face Oklahoma State on Monday night at Hilton Coliseum, despite 4 scholarship starters watching from elsewhere while undergoing COVID protocol. We were definitely thinking about our brothers and teammates, Rasir Bolton said. We don't know officially if the inactive list included players who tested positive or who were in quarantine for coming too close to someone who did. Nor do we know the status of Saturday's game at Mississippi State in the Big 12 SEC Challenge. We assume, though, if there are at least 6 healthy scholarship players, the game has a chance to be played. It's the rules, and it was significant in the Cyclones losing 81-60 Monday night, a game in which Iowa State led 11-2 early. Big 12 rules say a roster must include at least six scholarship players. Iowa State was already thin, with Blake Hinson sitting out due to a medical condition and Xavier Foster out for the season after undergoing foot surgery. That left the minimum 6, plus half of the roster's 4 walk-ons, eligible to play. Therefore, it wasn't so much the whys and wherefores of Iowa State's 6th conference loss without a conference win. It wasn't all about botched X's and O's or moments of solid play. It was about the Cyclones getting through the game without more roster casualties. With what Coach Steve Brohm had available for this game, there wasn't a ton of actual strategic coaching to be done. There wasn't a lot that he could do other than watch his healthy guys play as hard as they could for as long as they could, which they did. Iowa State was without starters Jalen Coleman-Lanz, Trey Jackson, Javon Johnson, and Solomon Young due to COVID-19 protocols. Walk-ons Carter Booth and Nate Schuster also were out. That left Bolton as the only starter healthy enough to play, and he played all right Monday night. He was joined by George Condit, Darlinston Dubar, Tyler Harris, and Jaden Walker in the makeshift starting lineup. But Condit didn't stay with them long after collecting his 2nd foul early in the game when his team led 13-4. After the 6'10" junior left, and remember, 6'8" Young wasn't available, Oklahoma State continued to own areas under the basket and a 32-14 halftime points in the paint advantage. Yeah, the game went about as expected, even though Cowboys star freshman Cade Cunningham didn't play. The Cyclones played the grittiest 10 or so minutes of the season in storming to an 11-2 lead in their first game since January 9th. Then fatigue gradually became a factor. We knew it'd be this way. We were right. Rules are rules. Word around the league a couple weeks ago was that one coach at another school, let's call him Bruce, thought about trying to get a game rescheduled because his roster dipped to 6, not below it. He decided otherwise and played on. And lost. Prohm had no such thoughts, and good for him. He's paid to coach. He had enough healthy players who wanted to play. We were ready to play, Prohm said. We've been out for a couple of weeks now, so we were ready to play. Unfortunately, we only had 8 guys total. Just an unfortunate situation. But I guess we all understand the landscape we're dealing with right now. And so we've got to push through and just continue to figure out the best way to manage this to get us back to 100%. I asked Bolton and Harris how they managed to escape the virus. I was curious how, in such a close sport as basketball, how some made it and others didn't. Follow the procedure put in place for us, Bolton said. Keep your mask on and follow the rules, and you should be all right. And Harris? I've been trying to stay to myself, he said, just keeping my distance, doing everything according to the safety protocols. Educated minds could wonder why Monday night's game was even played, snowstorm notwithstanding. Educated minds can even correctly wonder if it's not wise to forego all conference tournaments, not just the nation's most popular that's usually held in Kansas City. Those tournaments are nice, don't get me wrong. It gives teams a second chance to make something from an unfortunate season. It's for the fans. But do you want one player or staffer or support staffer from one also-ran team infecting other programs to the extent that teams might not be able to participate in the NCAA tournament? Of course not. Use that week, March 10th to 13th in the Big 12, to make up games, not in bringing 20 men's and women's teams to KC at the same time. And why they're still going ahead with plans to play Saturday's Big 12 SEC Challenge is beyond me. The almighty television dollar? I hope not, but I'd be naive at least not to wonder. Texas's Shaka Smart isn't coaching for a while after testing positive. Other Big 12 coaches have tested positive too, most notably Baylor's Scott Drew. TCU coach Jamie Dixon also announced a while back that he'd been positive. They're in charge of recruiting players and getting their teams to the NCAA tournament. They, too, are prisoners of the virus, just like we all are. I still shake my head in amazement about Iowa State making it through a 12-game football season as successfully as it did. I don't know which is more significant, actually, doing that, or beating Oregon in Iowa State's first New Year's Six Bowl. I know what was significant Monday night. I know that Prohm's healthy guys played as hard as they could play for 40 minutes. That's really all that could be expected, given the circumstance of this game. I'll also read this article by Matthew Bain from the sports section. School choice bill could cause big prep shift. Those who follow high school sports will want to pay close attention to a bill currently being deliberated in the Iowa Senate. Tucked away near the end of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' January 20th school choice bill, which focuses on topics such as scholarship funding and charter schools, is language that would cause a seismic shift in Iowa high school sports. In effect, students who open enroll from one district to another would no longer have to wait 90 days before participating in varsity sports. They could play right away. I would say our eyebrows are raised, Iowa High School Athletic Association Executive Director Tom Keating told the Register this week. Transfers athletic eligibility became a heated topic this fall for a couple of reasons. First, the high-profile transfers of out-of-state players because of the effects of COVID-19 in their home states, such as Ankeny's Arlen Bruce IV and Valley's Jake Rubley, led to a continued discussion of what constitutes a legitimate reason for immediate eligibility. And second, Des Moines Public Schools remained in online-only learning longer than other school districts, which prevented member schools' youth students from participating in sports. Arguments ensued that those students should have been allowed to transfer and have immediate eligibility elsewhere. That latter matter was a focal point of State Senator Brad Zaun's argument while supporting the bill during the Senate Education Committee meeting on Monday. Some of these kids, because they're stuck in the school district they're at, didn't have the opportunity their senior year in particular to do their extracurricular activities, said Zaun, a Republican from Urbandale, which in time could have possibly provided a scholarship for them to move on. Keating and the association are opposed to the removal of the 90-day waiting period for athletic eligibility. He said he believes the drafters of the bill included the language in question in order to be consistent. Quote, if you can go to whatever school you want, you shouldn't have to wait to play sports at whatever school you want. But in practice, Keating said, that idea just doesn't work. He said that this bill is still in its infancy stages, and he hopes the language that removes the 90-day waiting period will be modified or removed as the bill progresses through its various drafts. There are some things that I think will be identified during the discussion of the bill that will be aha moments, Keating said, where people say, oh, we'd better close that loophole, or we'd better be aware of this unintended consequence and write something in here to avoid that. If you're asking, do you think people will transfer schools for athletic reasons? My answer would be, they're already doing that. If the question is, do you think people will ramp it up if this bill is passed as currently written? I would say maybe. But again, this is in such a preliminary form that I want to see how it develops. Mike Baranek is the president of the Iowa State Education Association, which opposes the school choice bill as currently written. In a statement sent to the Register, Baranek said the bill would eliminate the High School Boys and Girls Athletic Association's regulatory authority. As the bill is written, a student could transfer in the middle of the school year or sports season and participate immediately, Baranek said. We think it is best to leave this policy as it is now written and to support our athletic associations. Melissa Peterson, the ISEA's government relations specialist, said that not only would removing the 90-day waiting period for transfers athletic eligibility curtail the IHSAA and Iowa Girls Athletic Union's regulatory abilities, but it could also lead to more recruiting taking place in Iowa high school sports. We know it does happen, not only across the nation, but also in Iowa, Peterson told the Register. Even at the high school level, as it relates to sports, a student could literally switch schools with the open enrollment policies in this proposed legislation and be immediately eligible for competition, which, again, flies in the face of the association, as well as the Iowa Girls Athletic Union. We just don't think it's a good policy, and frankly, we don't need to infuse any additional kind of recruiting relating to the competition element. We don't think that's the best for students. The Register contacted multiple lobbyists who supported the bill as currently written, but none was comfortable speaking on the record about the language specifically relating to transfers athletic eligibility. Multiple calls with the girls' union on Tuesday went unanswered. I'll turn now to the life section of the Register. The feature article here is titled National Honor, and then the subtitle says, Dasia Taylor, 17, is among the top 40 finalists in the Regeneron Science Talent Search. She pursued the research out of an interest in both medicine and a passion for equity. And this article is accompanied by a photograph covering about half the page of Dasia, who is an Iowa City West senior, as she poses with the award medals that she received on January 18th outside Hunter Auditorium in Iowa City. And in the photograph, she's shown from about the chest up with three medals, or actually, I guess there are four of them, with blue and white and red, or blue and yellow and black ribbons around her neck. And you can see the bronze colored circular medals at the bottom of each of the ribbons. She's holding two of those each in each hand, out from her chest to show the cameraman. She's wearing glasses and some large pearl earrings and smiling very happily in the camera. She's wearing a pinkish top with some sort of a black jacket over top of that in the photo. And here is the article. Iowa City student Dasia Taylor maintains that she's not a scientist, even after being nationally honored for creating sutures, or stitches, that change color when the wound they bind together develops an infection. Instead, Taylor's work stemmed from merging curiosity about the medical field with a passion for equity. "Even if you don't know what you're doing, just go with it," says Taylor, 17, a senior at West High School in Iowa City. "I stand by the idea that I stumbled into STEM by way of intellectual curiosity." Be curious, because that will afford you so many opportunities. She's been recognized as one of the top 40 students out of 300 nationally, and the only one from Iowa, from among 1,760 submissions in the Regeneron Science Talent Search. The competition, offered through the Society for Science and the Public, seeks out independent student research that addresses global issues. As one of the competition's top 40 finalists, Taylor will receive at least $25,000 for her efforts. The top 10, who will be announced in March after the finalists undergo a, quote, rigorous virtual judging process, will win anywhere from $40,000 to $250,000. Scholars were chosen based on their exceptional research skills, commitment to academics, innovative thinking, and promise as scientists, and hail from 198 American and international high schools in 37 states, Puerto Rico, Chinese Taipei, and Singapore, according to the nonprofit's announcement about this year's competition. According to the World Health Organization, infections following surgery are the most common complications of healthcare procedures in developing countries. As many as 1 in 5 women who have a cesarean section in Africa will develop an infection after the surgery, for example. In her research, Taylor came across a new type of stitches that can detect infections, which could help prevent dangerous post-surgery infections, but would be expensive to implement in places where they're most needed. For Taylor, that issue stood out. She has long been immersed in questions of equity. She began studying restorative justice practices in middle school, and now is the co-chair of the Iowa City Community School District's Equity Committee. It was all this fancy technology just to do a couple of basic principles of science and identify basic principles of wound healing. And so I was like, okay, that's cool and all, but the people who actually need it probably can't afford it. So she set out to create an alternative. And that's where the beats come in. "Here's where the science stuff happens," Taylor prefaced. "Natural indicators are substances occurring in nature, like turmeric, grape juice, cherries, red cabbage, and of course, beets, that change color when their level of acidity, or pH level, also changes. Human skin has a natural pH level of around 5, meaning it's acidic. When wounds develop, they lose acidity and transition to a pH range of around 8 to 10. So what I did was I found a natural indicator that changed color within that range," Taylor said. "That's what allows stitches dyed in beet juice to turn purple when the wound becomes infected." The idea to conduct research in the first place began with West High School teacher Carolyn Walling. She often gauges student interest in independent research and offers to oversee it. "Usually I don't get too many takers, a couple. And Taylor was just so excited when I mentioned it," Walling said. "She just had so many ideas and was so excited, and she just immediately got to work." The research itself took months to complete, and all of it outside of school. Taylor researched sutures, dyed them using beet juice, and tested pH levels from late September of 2019 up until Valentine's Day of 2020. Hers was 100% hers, and it was unique, Walling said. And it was innovative. No one's ever thought of that before. Not that we could find, anyway. So that's why it was so extraordinary. Now a senior, Taylor is in the process of applying to law school. The exact type of law she wants to go into, she says, is still up in the air. I'm a firm believer that you don't have to be confined to a box and just stay in one subject area. You can bounce around. If you're interested in it, go for it. End quote. At the bottom of the page of the Iowa Life section is an article from Angie Ferguson. The title, Is Alcohol Curtailing Your Fitness Gains? There are many benefits associated with reduced alcohol intake, including getting a better night's sleep, saving money, and reducing feelings of stress and anxiety. Perhaps a lesser recognized benefit, though, is how drinking less can mean better results from your workouts. Despite a dedicated exercise routine and healthy eating plan, many people would agree that they don't always see their efforts rewarded as fast as they would like. For those that drink alcohol, those Friday night beers or weekend wines could be part of the problem. While the effects of alcohol on weight vary significantly between individuals, research suggests that alcohol can impact weight gain because calories from alcohol are actually burned first, which may result in excess calories from food being stored as fat if a person has exceeded their recommended daily intake. In addition, we're not comparing apples to oranges because there are 7 calories per gram of alcohol versus 4 calories per gram of carbohydrate. Therefore, alcoholic drinks can also be high in calories and might lead you to inadvertently exceed your recommended daily intake despite proactively eating better at mealtimes and snacking more healthily. People also tend to find themselves more hungry when drinking alcohol or making poorer food choices when drinking and inhibitions are limited. Furthermore, the effects of alcohol consumption on an individual's body can easily last through to the next day, impacting that next training session. Research has found hangover symptoms produced by alcohol include electrolyte imbalance, hypoglycemia, gastric irritation, vasodilation, and sleep disturbances, which can make exercise sessions feel a lot harder and be the reason you send that last-minute cancellation text to your training partner. The American Council on Exercise reports weight loss and fitness as being one of the primary health goals for roughly half of young people aged 25 to 35 years old, yet only 10% said they were willing to reduce or stop their alcohol intake. With all of this in mind, it's fair to suggest that increased alcohol consumption could be hindering your attempts to reach your health and fitness goals. While you don't want to be told how to live your life or that you need to abstain from drinking alcohol altogether, if your current drinking habits might struggle to be classified as moderate, you could enhance your training outcomes and enjoy a number of other benefits. Hello, more disposable income, by reducing your alcohol intake. In an effort to support people in achieving their wellness goals, including better results in health and fitness, the National Institutes of Health has plenty of interesting information on the many benefits that can come from reducing alcohol intake. Their national campaign, Rethinking Drinking, Alcohol, and Your Health, offers a cavalcade of resources, treatment options, and support groups, even in this time of COVID-19. Online, you can visit rethinkingdrinking.niaaa.nih.gov to learn more. Today's live section also includes the Ask Carolyn column as written by Carolyn Hacks. The headline for that column today reads, Little Things Cause Big Irritation. Hi, Carolyn. Do you have any advice to help me get less irritated at little things? I try my best not to take this out on others, but I wish I could not get irritated in the first place. I am already in therapy for anxiety issues. Signed, Irritated. And Carolyn replies, irritation lives in the gap between what you have and what you want. Overcoming it involves finding peace with what you have. So your work in therapy will likely mitigate the problem. Here's something to try in the meantime. Imagine for a moment how you feel when you're late for a meeting and you miss your train. Now imagine the same missed train when you aren't late for anything. I'm guessing the difference is pronounced. And in the latter case, you're much calmer and more accepting. When you're dealing with irritation over small things, it can be helpful to think of this difference. Since you will never, ever achieve a state of being that doesn't include missed trains, figuratively speaking, your only option for stress reduction is to work on the other side of the equation, the calm perception side, where you accept what you can't control. So, what can you do to break out of the late state of mind? How can you manage your schedule, moods, expectations toward approximating the state of mind of people who can calmly occupy themselves till the next train comes, still figuratively speaking, instead of freaking out? For example, expect little things will go wrong, so you aren't surprised or let down when they do. Or give yourself extra time or leeway, especially for things you know are stressful. You can plan your responses ahead, too. Bring a book for when you're stuck in a waiting room, or repeat a mantra or breathing exercise, or stretch or take a walk. You can plan ahead for when people irritate you, too. A hard look at your own flaws and how others put up with them, whether out of fondness for you or their own general sense of decency, can clear a path to showing them the same forgiveness. I've got a little time left for some articles from the USA Today. I'll start with the short money line pieces. Support animals banned on Southwest March 1st. When the U.S. Department of Transportation gave airlines the go-ahead to ban emotional support animals in December, Southwest Airlines didn't immediately join its competitors in changing its policies. On Monday, the airline announced it will ban emotional support animals beginning March 1. Until now, they qualified as traditional service animals. The only animals that will be classified as service animals will be trained service dogs with documentation. Pizza Hut unveils Detroit-style pizza. Dubbed its biggest launch of the year, Pizza Hut rolled out a new pizza Tuesday, but it's not round. The Detroit-style pizza, available nationwide for a limited time, is rectangular with, quote, cheese all the way to the edges to create that crispy, thick, caramelized crust, end quote, the company said. The pizza also has a new vine-ripened tomato sauce that's available only on Detroit-style. There are four kinds of Detroit-style pizza, and prices start at $10.99, but do vary by location. Delta Airlines returns 400 pilots to flying duty. Delta Airlines plans to return 400 pilots to regular flying duties by this summer in a sign that it expects travel to increase over the peak vacation season from current low pandemic levels. The airline's Senior Vice President of Flight Operations, John Lafter, said in a memo that the airline is bringing back pilots to active flying well ahead of when we originally estimated. The 400 are not new hires. Through March, they are being paid with taxpayer money that Delta received as part of $15 billion in additional federal aid to the airline industry. I'll read part of another article about travel, but probably won't be able to finish it. This is written by Josh Roberts, and the title is Book Now, Pay Later, Trends Gain Traction. Even before the COVID-19 pandemic put the brakes on travel, Book Now, Pay Later deals and third-party services were gaining in popularity with travelers. But in this era of pent-up travel demand and general uncertainty about how and when life and travel will return to normal, the notion of putting a future vacation on layaway suddenly makes a lot of sense, and many travel providers are taking notice. Third-party travel financers, such as Uplift and Affirm, have been in the business for nearly a decade, but the challenges of the pandemic have brought other players to the table with such offers too. From hotels and airlines to resorts and tour operators, FamilyVacationist.com takes a look at how flexible booking options are reshaping the way we pay for travel. Purchasing travel can be stressful, especially for big ticket purchases paid all up front, says Brian Barth, CEO of Uplift, a buy now, pay later site focused exclusively on travel. Helping travelers pay over time gives them access to a vacation they might have never thought possible. Uplift partners with more than 150 airlines, cruise lines, vacation packagers, and resorts to offer a budgeting tool that lets travelers spread out their purchase rather than waiting until they have the entire cost of the trip on hand before they book. And because Uplift's installment payment plans are based on either no interest or low interest payments over a clear time frame, they're more economical than putting a trip purchase on a credit card. Most credit cards charge a late fee when a payment due date is missed, notes Barth, but Uplift never charges a late fee and there are no prepayment penalties. Consumers know exactly what their fixed monthly payment will be at booking, as well as how many months it will take to pay off their trip. The other big third-party financing site is Affirm, which offers financing options on everything from fitness equipment and electronics to furniture and travel. The buy now, pay later category was already on the rise, and the pandemic sparked an even greater surge, says Greg Fisher, Affirm's chief marketing officer. We believe this is both a result of the rapid acceleration of e-commerce and because consumers are more money conscious than ever and want transparent, flexible ways to pay for things they want and need, including travel. Barth agrees, crediting the pent-up demand for travel as a result of the pandemic for a strong uptick in bookings late last year. Our average daily transaction volume was up 32% month over month in December and 34% in January, he notes. The rise of flexible booking options isn't limited to third-party financiers. Even before the pandemic, most big hotel chains offered fully refundable reservations. Now, almost all of the major U.S. airlines have essentially created a buy now, fly later model too, by permanently eliminating the change fees amid the pandemic. Of course, there is one small catch. The kicker is that if you want to change your flight, you don't get a refund, only a voucher, says Brian Kelly, founder and CEO of The Points Guy, adding that you may not get the full value of your initial purchase if you rebook a cheaper flight. His main tip? Use your frequent flyer miles, because if you want to change or cancel, most of those fees have been waived, so you can get all of your miles and taxes back. I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut it off there and move on to Dear Abby now. The headline of her column, Drunken Flirting Puts Close Friend at a Greater Distance. The first of two letters says, Dear Abby, my husband and I have been close friends with a woman named Louise for 5 years. Recently, we were all hanging out and Louise got very drunk and tried to massage lotion into my husband's hands. She also hugged him, although he put his hands at his side and his whole body stiffened. My husband has expressed to me that these situations made him very uncomfortable, and they do the same to me. We talked about letting Louise know, but he felt it would only make her feel awkward around us. It has been a month, and I can't let it go. I'm finding excuses to avoid her. Should I continue trying to let this go, or is a conversation in order? Signed, Taken Aback in New York. Dear Taken Aback, if you, quote, let it go, it will probably happen again, and the friendship will be over. A conversation with Louise is overdue. She needs to know she must be more careful about her drinking, because the last time she became very drunk, she embarrassed not only your husband, but also you. The second letter says, Dear Abby, I have a male best friend I adore. When I tell other men about my bestie, they feel intimidated because he has a key to my apartment. We're not dating. We just have sex sometimes, and everyone that I try to be with knows about him. Must I give up on my bestie to be with the man I love, even though bestie and I promised each other that we will never break our bond for anyone? Signed, Complicated in Tennessee. Dear Complicated, if you hadn't been having sex sometimes with your bestie, the man you love might have been able to accept him. The answer to your question is yes, you will have to make a choice. Now the question I have for you is, which man do you think is the keeper? That is definitely a complicated situation in Tennessee. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And today's the day for the midweek shopping cart. It's read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.